Hello and welcome to a new episode of Computationally Yours. This is Computationally Yours. We are your hosts. I'm Dr. Sabha Kadri.
And I am Arshi Arora. Let's do something different today. Today, we plan to bring to you an inspirational story. In this episode, we'll be celebrating a scientific genius by sharing some fun facts from their scientific journey and talking a little bit about their research story as well.
This is the first one in an episode type where instead of talking about a scientific topic itself, we will celebrate famous scientists and their stories. Every scientist has their own journey, and listening to these stories can be very inspirational, like Arshi said. So let's talk about our very first profile in scientific genius.
Yay! Sabha, who is the very first scientist and who are we going to feature today?
Well, Arshi, this one was easy. A couple of weeks ago, I did an episode on junk DNA. A shameless plug here to please check out that episode.
Yes, you can check that one out later, but you don't need to hear it right now to continue with this one.
Right. So while researching for that episode, I mentioned Dr. Barbara McClintock. Later, I looked her up some more and I found her story to be so interesting. I thought we should dedicate an entire episode to her. And not just a list of all the work she did. I mean, there's Wikipedia for that. But really learn about her journey.
So the first thing you need to know about Dr. Barbara McClintock is that she was an American scientist and she was the first woman to have received the Nobel Prize that was unshared. The first woman to have received a solo Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine. She was awarded this in 1983, and by that time she was 81 years old. And this Nobel Prize was for her work from the 1940s and 50s.
Yes, that is the first thing about her that you should know, that she's a Nobel Prize winner. She discovered genetic transposition, that genes change positions on chromosomes. She made immeasurable contributions to the field of genetics. But her story is full of firsts, of her going against all odds and overcoming them successfully. So let's dive in.
So by the time McClintock started graduate school at Cornell University, which was in the botany department, by the way, it was already established that chromosomes are the basics of a heredity. That's how traits are passed between generations. Whether it is in animals or plants, it's the same mode of heredity.
Arshi, I want to take a slight digression and talk about a detail that is really important here. One of the obstacles for her, she got her PhD from Cornell University in 1927, but she also did her undergrad there. And when she decided to go into genetics after her undergrad, this was a time when women scientists were rare. And in fact, genetics at Cornell was taught in the plant breeding department, where women were not allowed in that department. So instead, she actually got her degree in botany by doing genetics in botany there. Her major was in cytology and her minor was in genetics.
But let's talk about her childhood for a minute. Mm-hmm. She has a very interesting story, which makes it easy to understand her unconventional choices for that time about how and what led her to Cornell.
Of course. What do you have for us, Arshi?
So she was the third of out of four children, her mother being a pianist, poet, and a painter, and her father was a physician. She was born in 1902, but she spent her early years from the time she was three to the time she was six with her aunt and uncle. She describes herself as an odd child. She would accompany her uncle, who was a fish dealer, in a horse-drawn cart around that time and who later got a motor car. And she said that later in her life that her interest in cars actually stemmed from watching her uncle repair his constantly breaking down car.
Dr. McClintock described herself as self-contained when she was a child. That means that she could keep herself entertained for long periods of time. She did like sports and sometimes she would just spend time with herself, sitting and thinking. According to her biography in the National Academy of Science, by the way, I strongly recommend that for anyone who's interested to learn more about her research contributions as well. According to her biography there, her parents were actually quite unconventional in their attitudes towards raising children. They were interested in what the children would and could be rather than what they should be.
That makes a lot of sense for what followed then. And I remember, I think there is a story about her where, like, I think she wanted to do ice skating and her parents bought her the best equipment available at that time and even let her skip school to skate.
That's really supportive parenting for sure. And even though her relationship with her mother was strained, her mother supported her unconventional choices. For example, there is a reported story where Barbara was playing in the streets as a, you know, she was a kid, and a neighbor scolded her not to play boys' games, but instead she should be doing things that girls do. Her mother called that neighbor and gave her a earful about never speaking to her daughter like that again.
That is so awesome. I think maybe for that time, her childhood or maybe her parents were like really ahead of their time.
Absolutely agree with that, Arshi. And so important to have a strong support system, especially as a child if you're doing things that are not conventional.
Yep, exactly. She especially had a very special relationship with her father, I think, who respected her as an individual and did everything to support her. Barbara loved science and she loved to study.
Yeah, and the story about her going to Cornell for higher education goes something like this. At that time, they didn't have much money and her mother was against having her go to Cornell because she thought that it would make her unmarriageable. Remember, this is 1918 and this is right after her high school. So Barbara took up a job at an employment agency and then she would spend her evenings just reading at the library. But then just days before the semester started, her father actually intervened. And I don't know the entire story, but she finally ended up taking a train to Ithaca to begin her bachelor studies at Cornell, where she would end up doing her PhD as well.
Wow, I think now it seems like it was meant to be that she finally managed to do her undergrad at Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that brings us back to Cornell again. Her first real contribution was identification of each of the 10 chromosomes in her organism of interest, which was
the maize. And she developed advanced techniques in cytogenetics to do this, things that did not exist when she started graduate school. So we've already talked about her getting her PhD in 1927. She continued working at Cornell, California Institute of Technology, and the University of Missouri in the early 1930s. And though her fame grew, she did not have a permanent position at Cornell because they did not have many women professors in any departments other than home economics at that time.
It seems weird, Sabha, because like I know I look up to all my female professors, my female mentors, and I think your PhD, your mentor was in your PhD was a female professor as well.
Right. My PI was definitely a woman professor. And this basically goes to show how far we've come in the field. I mean, we still have a lot of obstacles for women researchers and women scientists, but she was definitely one of the pioneers in her field at that time.
I agree. Another twist of fate that came for McClintock was in 1933. She was rewarded the Guggenheim Fellowship to work with the famous German geneticist around that time, Dr. Kurt Stern. This fellowship was in Berlin. And around that time, Stern fled Germany with the rise of Adolf Hitler and anti-Semitism. But McClintock still went to Germany, even relocated to the Botanical Institute in Freiburg. But her work was cut short due to the political situation in Germany. And she finally came back to the US in 1934. You know, sometimes great things happen to you, but sometimes the circumstances are such and the situation is outside our control and it can just as well take it away from us. But in the case of Barbara McClintock, she did not give up.
Yes, exactly. And then she came back to the United States. But then it's important to note that even with all of this work and fellowships and awards, even after this, it took her 3 more years before she got a job as assistant professor at University of Missouri with the help of Louis Stadler. But then that also had a lot of obstacles for her. She soon realized that she was not going to get promoted there and her employment depended on Stadler's presence somehow. So she left University of Missouri And she finally joined the genetics department of the Carnegie Institution of Washington, the most prominent lab at Cold Spring Harbor at that time, in the early 1940s. She remained there until her death in 1992. And throughout all of this, Dr. Barbara McClintock received many honors across her life.
You mean besides the Nobel Prize?
Yes, besides the Nobel Prize.
For example, I think we must mention that she was only the third woman to be elected to the National Academy of Sciences at the age of 42 because of all the significant work that she was doing.
Yeah, and actually, Arshi, here I would like to mention a huge honor that she received in 1971 when President Richard Nixon awarded her the National Medal of Science. So here's a quote that's directly from President Nixon about McClintock. It goes something like this. "I have read explanations of your scientific work, and I want you to know that I do not understand them. But I want you to know, too, that because I do not understand them, I realize how enormously important their contributions are to this nation. That, to me, is the nature of science."
Now, let's talk a little bit about her work. After her PhD, she continued her work in cytogenetics in the plant maze. She developed this method for using broken chromosomes to generate new mutations. She also crossed plants where the plant received a broken chromosome from each parent. And in such plants, she saw that unstable mutations were at an unexpectedly high frequency and a unique mutation which defined a regular site of chromosome breakage. This was so fascinating that she studied this chromosome breaking locus.
And after years of work, she published the conclusion in 1948 that the chromosome breaking locus actually moved from one chromosomal location to another, something that was completely unknown at that time. She called this transposition. And these transposable elements basically turn certain pigmentation genes on and off, which in her favorite organism, as we've mentioned, the maize, led to different colors of the maize kernels. This was the focus of her research for the rest of her career. And I'm sure we've oversimplified her research in these few sentences, but I really urge those who are interested to check out the links that we're going to leave in the description below.
Now, her work was definitely appreciated, but you can imagine that the idea of genes moving around the genome did not agree with conventional knowledge yet. There was serious doubt about whether her conclusions could apply to other organisms, or was it just a general behavior in maize?
Yes, let's take a second here to acknowledge that the appropriate phrase for her work would be ahead of its time.
Quite literally, right?
And it also makes me wonder that the entire purpose of science here, right, is to make groundbreaking discoveries. But we have so many instances in scientific history where groundbreaking work was not appreciated, sometimes long after the scientist passed.
True, that's very true. And in this story, at least her work got its recognition in her lifetime, because in the 1960s and 70s, with evolving technologies, like we have discussed in some prior episodes, that it was realized that these transposable elements are quite common in many organisms. That's when the importance of her work got more recognition. And that brings us to the last segment of our episode. Sabha, since you wanted to talk about Barbara McClintock, do you have a take-home message for us?
Let's see. So, well, I think if there's anything we can learn from Barbara McClintock, I might sound a little cliched here, but it's to follow our dreams and really carve our own path, even if there isn't one already paved for us. Another thing that, as we discussed earlier in the episode, which is so important, is having a strong support system that really help you realize those dreams. I mean, things are definitely better today for women in science, but there are still so many obstacles that we face. So I think that's my takeaway today.
So that brings us to the end of this episode. Listeners, let us know how you like this different format of the episode. Share your comments and let us know if you would like us to feature scientific genius of your choice. Please remember to subscribe to us so that you are up to date on our weekly releases every Tuesday. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram, details and description below.
And until next time, this is Computationally Yours.